Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, February 9, 2018, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon's topic is Dr. Hal Brand's new book, American Grand Strategy in the Age of Trump. My name is Wesley Hodges, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Dr. Hal Brands, who's the author of the book mentioned, and is the Henry A. Kissinger Distinguished Professor at the Henry A. Kissinger Center for Global Affairs at the John Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Also with us is Lester Munson, who is a principal in government affairs at the BGR Group. After our speaker's remarks, we'll open for an audience Q&A. So please have those questions pulling up in your minds before we begin. Thank you for speaking with us today. Dr. Brands, the floor is now yours.
Okay, thanks very much. I really appreciate you having me here, and thanks for everybody who's willing to spend their lunch hour with us. I think it'll be a good discussion. And so I guess just as a way of preface, I'll make about 15 minutes of remarks about the book and some of the core arguments it makes, and then we can have a little back and forth and open it up for discussion. And the standard disclaimer I like to make in talking about the book is that even though it's titled American Grand Strategy in the Age of Trump, it is both about President Trump and not about President Trump. And so it's not about Trump in the sense that the entire book is not devoted to making sense of U.S. policy on a day-to-day or issue-by-issue basis since January 2017. That's very difficult. Very difficult to hit a moving target in general. It's even harder with this administration. But the book is about Trump in a larger sense, because the purpose of the book is to answer what I see as the biggest grand strategic questions for America today. And because Donald Trump is president, those first-order questions in American policy are more open for debate today than any time in years. So there are always fierce debates about how the United States should handle some particular policy or challenge, but we really haven't had a larger first-order debate about the major purposes and ambitions of U.S. foreign policy since the end of the Cold War, perhaps even World War II. And so now is an opportune time to address these big overarching issues, and that's what I do. And so the book consists of seven chapters that each address a big question like how successful has U.S. grand strategy been historically, what was the Obama administration's approach to grand strategy and how effective was it, is American internationalism politically sustainable today, what might a more nationalistic American grand strategy look like, or what would happen if the United States were to radically retrench from the world, how much military power does America need in the current environment, and then finally, how should we understand the first year of the Trump administration? And I won't try to answer all these questions in detail here, just for reasons of time, but I will briefly highlight a few themes that cut across the various chapters. And the first of these is simply that you never really appreciate what you've got until it's gone or until it's at risk. And that's certainly true of U.S. grand strategy today. So there are plenty of fair critiques one can make regarding how America has handled itself in the world in recent decades. But when you think about the really big picture, the record has been pretty good. So basically, America's fundamental grand strategic decision after World War II was to build a relatively stable, open, and democratic international order. And it did so through a range of exertions that were pretty extraordinary, but only seem ordinary now because they're so familiar. And so things like anchoring the international economy, concluding alliances with dozens of countries around the world, maintaining a global military presence, and so on. And then after the Cold War, America's fundamental grand strategic decision was simply that we weren't going to stop. We weren't going to pull back dramatically once the Soviets were defeated. We were going to keep doing, and in some cases even intensify, the things we had done since the 1940s as part of an effort to extend American primacy and to expand the liberal international order. And every U.S. administration has pursued that goal in its own way, and there have been serious debates over particular policy issues, but the overarching grand strategic agenda has remained pretty much consistent. And I would argue that grand strategy has actually been fairly effective in making the post-war and now the post-Cold War era as relatively good as it has been. So by any reasonable historical comparison, The post-war and the post-Cold War eras have been relatively peaceful, relatively prosperous, and relatively liberal in the sense that democracy and human rights have spread farther than ever before. And there are surely a lot of reasons why that is, but also surely I think the fact that the world's most powerful country has been committed to achieving precisely these outcomes has contributed to bringing that situation about. And so all of that is worth appreciating. And moreover, and this is a second theme of the book, I think that the most popular alternatives to this grand strategy would be quite dangerous. So if the United States were to withdraw from Europe and the Middle East and East Asia, if it were to adopt a more offshore balancing type approach to the world, as many academic critics have advocated, it would not enjoy greater security at lesser price. It would not get more for less. It would get less for less because it would be withdrawing the pillars that have sustained international stability and prosperity for the past 70 years. It would be removing the mechanisms that have stifled geopolitical conflict in the world's key theaters. It would be creating incentives for the very type of geopolitical instability and revisionism that the United States has long sought to forestall. And so the long-term result, most probably, is that the United States would find itself having to intervene to set things right again, because we would discover, as we've discovered twice in the past, that we don't want to live in a violent and conflict-plagued world. But having retreated, we would be doing so from a far less advantageous position than we have today. And so the point here is that U.S. grand strategy, as it has been practiced over the decades, looks pretty good in its own right, and it looks even better compared to the likely alternatives. But just to be clear, and this brings me to a third theme of the book, this isn't to say the U.S. grand strategy has been perfect or that it doesn't need adapting today. There have been mistakes and blunders and even disasters over the decades. We can all probably come up with our own favorite list. Right now, there are aspects of American foreign policy that aren't working as well as they ought to be, whether those aspects have to do with alliance management and burden sharing, or whether they have to do with the impact of globalization on the working and middle class. And then finally, I think it's fair to say that the outlook for U.S. strategy is becoming more challenging today, simply because the world is a more volatile and competitive place now than at any time since the end of the Cold War. And so I would wholly endorse the idea that there are ways in which American grand strategy needs to change in the coming years, just as American grand strategy has periodically had to adapt in the past, during the Nixon years or during the Reagan years, for instance. But what would be tragic is if the United States were to fundamentally break with the broad patterns of post-war and post-Cold War statecraft, because those patterns have proven fairly constructive. And this brings me to a fourth theme of the book, and this has to do with the question of whether there is still a domestic political consensus in support of American internationalism as we have traditionally defined it over the past 70 years. Because certainly the results of the 2016 presidential election might lead one to question whether that is still the case. For better or worse, our current president broke all of the rules when it came to talking about foreign policy on the campaign trail, when it came to allies, when it came to trade, when it came to Russia, and so on. And he even critiqued the core insight of U.S. engagement with the world over the past 70 years, this idea that we can best protect our own interests by pursuing a broadly beneficial, positive-sum vision of international order. And yet, despite all this, and despite alienating almost the entire universe of Republican foreign policy experts, Trump won. And so one of the things I do in the book is to delve into the public opinion polling, to look at the development of domestic debates on foreign policy since the end of the Cold War, and to ask whether American internationalism is politically dead in light of the rise of Donald Trump. And the answer is only a little bit reassuring, because the answer is basically not yet. So there's not a massive popular revolt against American internationalism occurring simply because the public opinion polls show that Americans still like their alliances, they still like free trade, they still like having the most powerful military in the world, etc. But at the same time, Trump didn't come out of nowhere. And if you dig deep, you can see in fact, that there were a variety of cracks in the internationalist consensus that he managed to burst through. And those cracks are the result of a variety of things. They're the result of public disillusion with the conduct of long wars in Iraq and Afghanistan over the past 15 years. They're the result of skepticism about supporting significant expenditures overseas at a time when the working class and lower middle class have been getting pummeled economically. They are the result of anger at the effect that China's insertion into the international economy has had on American manufacturing. And they're also just the result of the fact that the end of the Cold War deprived the United States of the threat that had justified American internationalism for 45 years. And so after the Cold War ended, we were bound to have an anti-internationalist candidate come to the forefront at some point. We saw this in the early 1990s with Pat Buchanan. We saw it much more powerfully in 2016 with Donald Trump. But the bottom line is that there's greater public ambivalence about the U.S. role in the world than there has been for any time in decades, really. And that ambivalence is probably going to remain even after Trump leaves the scene. And this brings me to the final issue that I'll just briefly discuss here, which is this question of what effects Donald Trump is having on American foreign policy so far, and what sort of situation he'll leave behind when he does depart the scene. And I'll just say here that when I tell people that the title of my book is American Grand Strategy in the Age of Trump, they always make the same joke, which is that, well, it must be a pretty short book. And that's fair enough, but the point I would make is that even for the most seemingly erratic and undisciplined leaders, and I would certainly put Trump in that category, grand strategic decision-making is unavoidable. Every leader has a theory of how the world works and how their country fits within the world, no matter how contradictory that theory may be. Every leader has to make choices about how to address critical policy challenges. All of these issues are deeply grand strategic in nature, and all of them are inherent in governing. And so to borrow a little bit from Trotsky, you may not be interested in grand strategy, but grand strategy is still interested in you. Now, when it comes to Trump himself, making sense of his impact on American grand strategy is a little bit tricky, because in a lot of ways the policies have been more normal than the president. If you were to add up all of Trump's rather unorthodox campaign proposals, all of the ideas he put forward in 2015, 2016, and then you were to compare them to the policies he's actually pursued, you'd see that the vast majority of his campaign pledges have not been fulfilled. Trump hasn't yet started trade wars with China or Europe. He hasn't withdrawn U.S. forces from Europe or reconciled with Russia. He hasn't withdrawn from NAFTA or attacked North Korea or torn up the Iran deal. And there are actually issues where his policy has been pretty mainstream. So I think his Afghanistan policy, for instance, is probably where most Republican presidents would have ended up. And the reasons for this have primarily to do with the various constraints that Trump has faced. These are constraints imposed by his advisors, by the Congress, by the courts, or simply by reality. But the fact remains that Trump hasn't simply blown up American foreign policy right away. And in fact, we've seen some Republican observers argue that his statecraft has actually been fairly sober and constructive, even if the tweets and the rhetoric perhaps have not. And I think there's something to this argument, but I would still say that it goes too far for two key reasons. And the first is simply that Trump himself has not changed. He clearly wants to or has tried to change policy more dramatically on a number of these issues. And there are still several areas where it may be that the blow-up simply hasn't happened yet. Right? It may be that the NAFTA renegotiations will deadlock in 2018, for instance, and then Trump will decide to terminate that agreement. And this relates to the second and bigger problem, which is that Trump doesn't actually have to carry out all of his campaign promises to damage American foreign policy. Ideas and words and atmospherics matter when you're the president of the United States. And what Trump has been doing through his behavior, through his mannerisms, through his ideas, is undermining a lot of the more intangible qualities that have made American foreign policy effective over the years. And so he is undermining the idea that the United States stands for something more than its own naked self-interest in international affairs, the belief that there is a group of allies to which we are bound, not just by temporary or transactional dealings, but by deeper bonds that are forged from common values and common purposes, the sense that the United States is the world's foremost advocate for democracy and human rights, the perception that the United States is a reliable and basically competent actor in international affairs, America's reputation as a country that's willing and able to take the lead in solving the world's most critical geopolitical and economic problems, and then finally, the soft power that has long complemented American hard power. And through his actions, through his words, I think the president has really inflicted a lot of damage on all these attributes of American policy and power, and in ways that I'm happy to discuss in greater detail. And I think that the damage will only worsen the longer his style of policy persists. If it's 4 years of Trump, the damage will be non-trivial, but probably not irreparable. If it's 8 years of Trump, or if Trumpism outlasts Trump, that could potentially be more serious still. And so there's really a deep irony in Trump's foreign policy, that the president claims that his America First agenda is going to maximize American wealth and power, but really his behavior is diminishing the American superpower and the international order it constructed. And I'll just close by saying that there is an additional tragedy here, which is that if Trump were a different type of individual, he might actually have been positioned to have a more constructive impact on American strategy. Because some of the ideas these put forward really aren't at all crazy. I mean, the idea that we need to really get our allies' attention with respect to burden sharing, the idea that countries like China have taken advantage of the international order without fully playing by its rules, these ideas are essentially correct, in my view. And in fact, one of the things that I argue in the book is that the United States could use a slightly more nationalistic grand strategy today. So a strategy that doesn't reject the tradition of American internationalism, but one that does take a slightly harder-edged approach to redistributing burdens and benefits within the international system. So you could call this internationalism with nationalist accents. And Trump certainly had the political credibility to pursue this sort of strategy coming out of the 2016 campaign, but he lacked the temperament, and he lacked the sophistication. Because a strategy of this sort requires shrewdness, and it requires calibration. You've got to be able to rock the boat without tipping it over. And I think, above all, it requires an understanding of the virtues of the internationalist tradition one would be trying to adapt. And so to give you an example, I think Richard Nixon had all of these things, and he was able to carry out something sort of like this in the 1970s. He managed to reallocate international burdens, update U.S. alliances, and basically achieve an adjustment of U.S. foreign policy within an internationalist framework. Unfortunately, President Trump doesn't appear to have any of these things. And that really is a shame, because it means that we are missing a chance to adapt U.S. strategy in a constructive way, and I think we're looking at more damaging effects instead. So those are some of the major arguments of the book. I'll go ahead and stop there so we can get into the discussion.
Thanks, Professor. That was a terrific terrific opening, and I think there's a lot of material to dig in here, and it's a great overview of a lot of the things that really do need to be discussed. Let me start with my own observation that I don't think the Trump election was all that different from previous elections, and I think I would go back to 1992, and if you identify the four big elections, presidential elections, Clinton versus Bush in 92, Bush versus Gore, Bush the son versus Gore in 2000, McCain versus Obama in 08, and then Trump versus Hillary Clinton in 2016, in each case, the more isolationist candidate prevailed. Bill Clinton ran on a "it's the economy, stupid" against a very internationalist George H.W. Bush. 8 years later, George W. Bush ran on a essentially against nation building, while running against a Vice President Al Gore who talked about internationalism and climate change and international cooperation in that arena. In 08, Senator Obama successfully painted John McCain is kind of a continuation of George W. Bush's what became a very internationalist and interventionist administration. And then, of course, Trump ran as an explicitly America First platform in 16. In each of the three previous cases, the president, after running as a candidate on a more isolationist platform, became an internationalist interventionist president to greater or lesser degrees. Even Obama, who ran explicitly against the wars in particularly in Iraq but also Afghanistan, became an interventionist, at least for a time. Are we not seeing the same dynamic here with Donald Trump, and despite the craziness of the tweets and the rhetoric that seems, as you correctly noted, is unprecedented? Aren't we seeing the same dynamic here unfold of an outsider who's a critic of the consensus American approach of leading internationally, someone who campaigns, who is more on the side of let's bring things home and care for the American people first, eventually growing into that role of American leader? And hasn't Trump essentially done the same thing that these other presidents have done, which is have a campaign rhetoric that sounds very isolationist, but then a policy and a grand strategy that is effectively a continuation of years of American leadership, really since the end of World War II, since World War II, essentially. So let me just challenge you on that a little bit and say, is it really that much of a divergence under Trump, what we're seeing right now?
So I think you're right to flag the point that every winning candidate since the end of the Cold War has argued that the United States ought to do less in international affairs than it was doing under the previous guy. I think what changed in 2016 was that you had a candidate who was voicing opinions that previously would have been not just sort of retrenchment-minded, but basically disqualifying, right? And so you had sort of an extremity of views in a number of cases on Trump's behalf that I think outstripped anything you saw from Bill Clinton in 1992, who did say it was the economy, stupid, but also said the United States needed to be more forward-leaning in supporting democracy around the world. That was one of his critiques of the George H.W. Bush administration, right? You had the, you know, when George W. Bush ran for the presidency in 2000, he was against nation building, but he was for doing more to thwart emerging competitors like China and so on and so forth. And what Trump did was express views that were so far outside of the mainstream, whether it had to do with alliances, whether it had to do with questions like whether the United States had any moral right to try to promote democracy and human rights abroad, that basically the guardians of the foreign policy tradition within his own party not simply abandoned him, but openly rebuked him. And what had changed in the electorate, I think, was that it was no longer disqualifying to express those opinions. So every time we had, after World War II, that we had a candidate who was so at odds with the American internationalist tradition, and the people I would put in this category would be people like Robert Taft in 1952, McGovern in 1972, Pat Buchanan in 1992. Those folks were either defeated in the primaries or they were trounced in the general election. And that didn't happen this time. And so I think it indicates that there is something different about the way that the American people certainly are viewing foreign policy. It's not that they voted for Trump's approach to the world necessarily, because the opinion polls indicate so far that approach is not particularly popular, or at least the parts of it that are quintessentially Trumpian are not particularly popular. But what it indicates is they didn't care enough about preserving the post-war tradition of American statecraft to reject someone like Donald Trump. And so that brings me to you know, the second part of your question, which is, you know, how much has Trump adapted? Has he not simply picked up the mantle of international leadership in the post-war order as all of his predecessors did? You know, Trump seems to be fighting it a heck of a lot harder than most of his predecessors. And I think the real difference here is that it's just very clear in the president's own behavior and the way he talks about international affairs that he really doesn't personally believe in the foreign policy that the United States has pursued for the past 7 years, because the way he talks about foreign policy really hasn't changed from the way it was on the campaign trail. And so, yes, there have been a number of initiatives where the rhetoric has proven to be more radical than the policy, and in large part that's because he's just confronting a lot of inertia in American strategy. In some areas, it's because he's tried to change policy and his advisors or the Congress have blocked him. That was the case, I think, with respect to Russia policy, with respect to coercive interrogation techniques as well. But if the question is, does the president himself seem to be shifting how he thinks about the world, then so far I haven't seen much evidence of that. And I'll just give one example of this, which I think kind of proves the rule, which is, look at the difference between the national security strategy and the speech that the president gave the day the national security strategy was released. So the national security strategy is a fairly mainstream document. It talks about the value of the post-war international order. It's very clear with respect to who America's allies are and what the benefits of those alliances are and who its adversaries are. The same day the president gave a speech at the Woodrow Wilson Center which was basically sort of full-throated America First. So he says that America's allies are the chief offenders in terms of exploiting American generosity and largesse, talked about all of the great cooperation he couldn't wait to have with Vladimir Putin, and so on. And so there have been areas in which policy has adapted, but I don't think the president himself has sort of grown into the role.
Let me quickly react to that and say I think you're entirely correct that you can tell the difference between kind of a cabinet-written document like the National Security Strategy and then a more of a Trumpian speech where his imprint is a little more on it. But isn't it fair to point out that, you know, while Trump as kind of the bad cop, he also hired all the good cops to be in the cabinet and supporting him, and that this dynamic is also kind of a direct outcome of his approach. And I'm not trying to ascribe any particular genius to it. It just seems like it's fair to point out that, yes, his rhetoric hasn't changed, but he's the one who hired a Mattis and a Tillerson and a McMaster to guide a more sensible policy.
Yes, although, to be honest, I don't know, you're right, that he has hired all those people, and I do consider all those people to be fairly sensible, but I don't think that the president would say, I hired them to execute a sensible foreign policy. I think the reality of the situation was that Trump's views were so far at odds with sort of the traditional American approach to foreign policy that it was virtually impossible for him to staff the administration with people who both, A, really believed in his worldview, and B, knew enough about government to get things done. And so you could see that. I mean, there just weren't a lot of full-throated America First advisors out there, and the ones that did get brought into the administration, Mike Flynn, for instance, Steve Bannon, relatively quickly were pushed out because either, you know, in Flynn's case, they ran into legal trouble, or in Bannon's case, because he simply had a hard time coexisting with the others. So I think it was actually almost inevitable that Trump would have to turn to people who didn't necessarily agree with his worldview, precisely because his worldview was so different.
Let me ask one last question before, Wesley, before we open it up to the callers. How much, Professor Brandt, how much can we compare the Trump divergence from the traditional approach to what I think of as Obama's divergence? And maybe this doesn't fall exactly into the category of grand strategy. I defer to your judgment here, but President Obama campaigned on talking to our enemies. He campaigned on talking to Cuba and talking to Iran, which, while not totally unprecedented, was rather unusual. And then, in fact, not only was he talking to Iran, he essentially, in addition to being the architect of the nuclear agreement, tilted, really did more than that in Middle East policy. It was not just the between the four squares of the paper on the nuclear deal. U.S. policy changed in the Middle East, and we started tilting in a much greater degree towards our enemies and away from our friends. You saw a complete change in the way the U.S. approached the Middle East. Israel and Saudi Arabia would be the first to tell you. So how much, and given that that was the main achievement, certainly of President Obama's second term, if not his entire presidency in terms of foreign policy, how much is, and I view that as a divergence from the direction America had been going in for decades, where we rewarded allies and punished enemies. How much is that divergence comparable to what President Trump has done, both in the campaign and during his first year?
So I think that Obama did clearly believe that the United States was overextended in the Middle East. I think he clearly believed that the previous administration had blundered by getting into such deep military engagements in the greater Middle East. And Obama was determined to sort of rebalance, to coin a phrase, American foreign policy by becoming less invested in the Middle East so we could shift attention elsewhere. And I think, as I point out in the book, But I don't think the logic of that was wrong. I think we were over-invested in the Middle East circa 2007, 2008. But the rebalance was not carried out in a particularly adept fashion because Obama was so preoccupied with winding down American involvement in Iraq, for instance, that he was really resistant to making the marginal investments that might have helped lock in what security and stability had been achieved at such a high price by 2010, 2011. And so I certainly, you know, indict the Obama administration for that. With respect to Iran, you know, I think that it's easy actually to overstate how great the divergence was there. So the idea of dealing with the Iranian nuclear program through a combination of multilateral negotiations and economic sanctions and other pressures was not an Obama administration idea. That was the Bush administration strategy that they hit upon in about 2006 and really struggled to implement, in part because of the diplomatic spillover from Iraq. But that was essentially a decision that was initially made under the Bush administration. The Obama administration, of course, insisted on reinventing the wheel, as every new administration does, but came back to that strategy. There was certainly some intellectual attraction within the Obama administration to the idea that you could integrate Iran into a more stable Middle Eastern order. I would fully agree with that. I'm not sure I would agree with the argument that the United States tilted toward Iran, and I'm quite sure that the Iranians would not agree with that, because the Obama administration, for all of the troubles that it had with its Gulf allies and with the Israelis, which I think it's quite right to flag that, you know, also sold them more arms than any previous administration. And so there was absolutely an effort to get to a better relationship with Iran, but it did not necessarily entail an abandonment of America's traditional partners in the Gulf. But having said that, sort of in defense of the Obama administration, let me make one point, which is that I think the strongest continuity between Obama and Trump is actually rhetorical. And this is a little bit of an odd thing to say because Obama and Trump in a lot of ways couldn't be more different. But certainly with his words, Obama did signal a certain weariness, a certain ennui with American foreign policy as it's been practiced for decades. And so when I really want to annoy my Democratic friends, I ask them, who was the first president to call American allies free riders? Who was the first president to say that we needed to do nation building at home as opposed to nation building abroad? Who was the first president to really deride the contributions of the foreign policy community in D.C.? And of course, the answer in all three cases is not Trump, it's Obama. And so you can certainly see some intellectual traces of ideas that would take on much larger and some ways different form under Trump actually getting started under Obama.
Let me just end on a humorous note, Hal, and say when I want to irritate my Democratic friends, I say, look, we got through the first half of the Obama-Trump era just fine. We'll get through the second half okay, too.
Yeah, that's a good one. That probably does the trick, I would imagine.
Every time. Wesley, I think we're throwing it over to you.
Okay, wonderful. Well, let's go ahead and move to audience questions. While we wait for any questions from the audience, just want to say that how much I enjoyed that discussion. I do have one question for you, Dr. Brands. I guess regarding the president's decision to move the embassy in Israel, how would you characterize that and the scheme of grand strategy?
So I think there is you could make the argument that there's a geopolitical logic to that move. I don't think that's why it was done. I think that it was done largely for political purposes. I think this is something that you know, President Trump thought would play well to, and he was right about this, that it would play well to a certain portion of his base, and he wanted to do that, and that's fine because presidents often do that. I think if you wanted to make the argument that there was a geopolitical logic to it, the logic would go something like this, and this is not to say necessarily that I endorse the logic, but this is how I would describe it. So the logic would go something like this. The major obstacle to peace in the Middle East is the belief of the Palestinian leadership that there is some better deal out there than the Israeli government is offering. And this is not a groundless belief, because we've seen this belief manifest a couple of different times at sensitive points in the peace process. So in 2000, Yasser Arafat thought that if he held out, he would get a better deal from the next administration. That was a catastrophic mistake. In 2007, 2008, and the negotiations that came out of the Annapolis process, the Palestinian leadership made a similar calculation. And so if you were looking to do something dramatic to show that, to show the Palestinian leadership and the Palestinian population that no, in fact, your bargaining position is only getting worse over time, and so you need to come to the table and cut a deal before facts on the ground that are prejudicial to your cause are simply created, you could paint that picture. Again, I don't think that was the reason that the president did it, and the reason you can tell is that if the reports are to be believed, virtually all of his foreign policy team opposed this decision. And the other reason you can tell is that I think even if that was your logic, it would have made more sense to do that in the context of an emerging negotiation. And the reason for this is that was, whether you think it was a good decision or not, it was a significant reward to the Israelis. And so presumably any agreement with the Palestinians is going to require some sort of concession that is painful for the Israeli government and population to make. And so if that's the case, it would make more sense to hold back this carrot until you were in a position to elicit that concession. And so for those reasons, I think that the logic of this was more political than geopolitical.
Thank you, Dr. Brands. It looks like we do have one question from the audience. Let's go ahead and move to our first caller.
What do you see as the impact of Trump's visit and speech to the Saudi Arabian meeting of the Arab states last year in the context of being the first world leader to identify the elephant in the room being the weaponization of the religion of those countries?
So I think this is an example of an initiative that kind of cuts both ways, in the sense that I think there were both positive and negative aspects of it. And so I would give the president credit for directly addressing the very issue that you mentioned, and sort of speaking bluntly in the heart of the Middle East about the ideological causes of terrorism and the need for partner governments in that region to frankly get more serious about attacking the causes of radicalization and sort of dealing with the perversion of Islam that drives a good deal of this. And so, yes, full credit to the administration for saying that. I think there were two pieces of that speech, or perhaps that visit more broadly, that were less productive and that speak to broader challenges the administration has faced. The first was that the president made a point of publicly saying that he would not be lecturing the Saudis on human rights abuses, precisely at the time that he was showing no hesitation about lecturing America's democratic allies on their perceived failings, whether foreign or domestic, right? So no hesitation about beating up Angela Merkel for her refugee policy, for instance. And I think that what this did is it fed the early impression, particularly in Europe, that the president was more personally comfortable dealing with autocratic leaders than with some of America's longtime democratic allies. And I think that was an unfortunate message to send. I mean, there's always room for discretion in thinking about how much you want to emphasize human rights issues and dealing with an authoritarian yet important ally like Saudi Arabia. But sending that signal publicly, I think, probably had some counterproductive effects. The second aspect, I think, that was a little bit counterproductive was that trip also was the prelude to the UAE-Saudi confrontation with Qatar, which emerged in early June. And it's still not entirely clear whether Trump was advised of this beforehand or whether he simply sort of egged the Saudis and the UAE on as it was unfolding. But it was of a piece with this administration's tendency, certainly during the first half of 2017, to essentially say, okay, we're going to outsource our policy of getting tough with Iran to the Saudis and the Emiratis, and we're going to no longer worry so much about trying to tamp down the disputes within the Gulf Cooperation Council. And that led to something that I think was actually quite counterproductive, because if the goal of the Saudi-UAE confrontation with Qatar was to break Qatar away from Iran, it's had precisely the opposite effect. I mean, Qatar has deeper ties with Iran today precisely because it's so isolated among its other neighbors. And it's created a great deal of instability within America's various partners in the Gulf. And so certainly you wouldn't want to hold the Trump administration wholly accountable for that, or even primarily accountable for that, because that was a Saudi and UAE decision. But certainly that trip conveyed the message that the United States was encouraging the Saudis to sort of get tough with countries that were seen to be in league with Iran in a way that had some counterproductive effects. So I would give them high marks for tackling the radicalization issue, but lower marks for those other issues that I mentioned.
Thank you, caller, for your question. Looks like there's one more question in the queue. Let's move to our next caller.
This is David Hubert in Atlanta. I almost want to disagree with the professor, not down the line, but for the most part. I think the attributes that he is ascribing to Trump are ascribable to Obama. And I think Obama's positions gave direct line rise to the election of Trump, which I suggest helps prove my point.
So just to respond to that, I mean, I think I would go back a little bit to the answer I gave to Lester's comment from a few minutes ago, which is that I think there are aspects of the Obama approach to foreign policy, and particularly Obama's rhetoric, that do prefigure some of the things we have seen with the Trump administration. So certainly the frustration with American allies, the frustration with sort of what both of these presidents saw as the Washington foreign policy elite, the idea that the United States was overextended abroad. Yes, you can absolutely see a bit of a lineage running back to Obama and even before in some cases. But there were also quite significant differences between Obama and Trump. And so Obama absolutely believed that the United States needed to be at the forefront of efforts to, for instance, deepen the international trade order and to address major transnational challenges such as climate change. Whether you think that the Paris Accords were a good idea or not, clearly there was a theory that Obama had about America's role in the world on that issue that was very different than Donald Trump's theory. And you can see the same thing with respect to trade. So the Obama administration was a little bit slow off the blocks, but it did end up pursuing and obtaining an agreement to bring the Trans-Pacific Partnership into existence. This would have been, a trade agreement encompassing about 40% of global GDP, would have been extremely significant in that sense. And of course, the Trump administration backed out of that agreement immediately. And so you could point to other areas of divergence, but I would just say that I think, it cuts both ways. There are certainly aspects of Obama that you can see in Trump, but on a number of other issues, there's sort of a night and day difference.
If Wesley, if you don't mind letting me follow up on that with a question for Hal. Hal, I know you see Trump as a kind of a Pat Buchanan-like president, and there's a lot of merit in that, and I tend to more see him as a Bill Clinton-like figure. What virtues can we find, if any, in Trump's sustained playing to his base on issues both international and domestic, in bringing that kind of Jacksonian voter, the white vote in the South, if you will, in the Midwest, the folks who are a little more isolationist, less internationalist, the kind of the Trump base voters, how much has him been playing to the base? Is there a virtue in that he can bring them towards a more sensible and robust American leadership in the world, since, as you've said, his policies have actually diverged quite a bit from what his campaign rhetoric was. So in other words, is there a value in having Trump as president and bringing those folks back into the mainstream? And if there is a value, if there is a virtue, how much of one is there?
So that's a great question. And I think the question is it depends. And it depends on how Trump interacts with that group of voters and with the American public writ large. And so, yes, absolutely. Donald Trump understood. He had a deep political insight, which is that Jacksonian voters were feeling alienated from the American political system and from American foreign policy, and that he could tap into that. And in some ways, I mean, it's important to point out that I very deliberately avoid characterizing Trump as isolationist, because he's not isolationist. He's a nationalist, right? So Trump did say we should pull back from certain commitments overseas, certain ambitions, but he said we should do some things more aggressively, right? So we should go after terrorists more aggressively. We should have a bigger and more powerful military. And I think aspects of that are very important. So I think it is important to sort of recover the Jacksonian sense that the United States needs a military that's not just the best, but the best by far. And that's particularly important now as we're facing more competition from countries like Russia and China. I think absolutely there it's hard to have American foreign policy be sustained over a long period without tapping into Jacksonian ideas. The one hesitation I have about really endorsing this, though, is that it's not entirely clear to me that Trump's goal is to bring Jacksonian voters into the American foreign policy consensus, which is something I would very much support, or whether his goal is simply to convince American voters that American foreign policy is a sucker's game, at least as we've executed it for the last 70 years. And so this is where how the president talks about things really matters. And so if the president is going to make the case that the United States needs to have a stronger position in the world because our national honor is at stake and our interests are at stake and sort of the classic Jacksonian approach, I would very much support that. If he's going to make the argument that the United States really has no interests in places like Somalia or Yemen, for instance, or in Ukraine, and that the United States should pull back into sort of a narrower definition of its own interests, that's often the way the president has talked, and I don't think that has a constructive effect. So I would just say that I think it's a little bit too early to tell here, and it really depends on how Trump's narrative of American foreign policy evolves as his presidency proceeds.
Thank you both. It looks like there is one more question in the queue. So with that, let's just move to our next caller.
Thank you. Greg Lawson in Ohio. I have a question about kind of the resumption of great power competition, specifically Russia and China. And I'm wondering how much, if Nixon went to China to use triangular diplomacy vis-a-vis the Soviet Union, could there ever be an argument that the reverse situation should be true today, given some of the concerns, long-term geopolitical concerns with China? And Trump seemed to be moving in that direction. Obviously, there's been a lot of reasons why that hasn't moved forward, to say the least. But would that make sense as a geopolitical strategy to attempt sort of a reverse Nixon to China? And could Trump do that, or is he too hemmed in to be able to do that? Can he articulate that?
So that's a great question, and I think I'll sort of tackle it in reverse order. So if the reverse, if I understand you correctly, right, is the reverse of Nixon going to China, Trump going to Russia, and that I don't think this president can do it, just because there are the antibodies to any sort of Trump engagement with Russia are so strong right now, for a variety of reasons, as you point out, that the president is basically hemmed in. I mean, he's incredibly constrained by Congress on Russia sanctions issues, and I think he's just constrained by the larger political system with respect to any sort of engagement with Russia. I mean, you saw sort of the media blow-up that occurred when it became clear that U.S. and Russian intelligence officials had met recently. I mean, that sort of testifies to the political climate today, whether you think that climate is justified or not justified. And it's also, I don't know that Trump actually, I don't know what Trump's theory of reconciling with Putin is. And it's hard for me to tell whether he is for reconciling with Putin just because Obama was against it in the last 3 years of his presidency, or whether there is some deeper geopolitical logic. That said, this is a really profound question for U.S. foreign policy in the years ahead. It's certainly not in America's interest to have negative relationships with both Russia and China at the same time. And since China is the stronger of those two powers, it probably makes sense to align. It might make sense to align with Russia against China at some time in the future. The problem is that it's not exactly clear how you get from here to there today. So in the late 1960s, China feared the Soviet Union more than it feared the United States. That's not true today. The Russians are more worried about the United States than they are about China. That might change over the long term, and there are some reasons for that, but it's not the case today. And furthermore, the divisions between the United States and Russia are so profound that it's hard for me to see what sort of the grand bargain would look like. You know, would it, because I don't think that simply lifting the Ukraine-related sanctions, for instance, would be sufficient. I think the Russian grievances with the United States go far deeper than that. And so, yes, at sort of the level of, you know, geopolitics 101, it would absolutely make sense for the United States to be working with one of these other powers against the other one. But given that they are both sort of authoritarian revisionist challengers that are making efforts to undermine the international order that we've constructed, it's just hard to see how you get there in the near term. So I think that's a real challenge for American statecraft, but one for which I don't have a good answer at this point.
Let me ask a follow-up question, Hal, since we're getting close to the end of the time here. Aside from the Russia question, let's talk about China. What is the Trump administration approach to China? I can't tell if we are trying to use China to solve the North Korea problem, or if China is using North Korea to solve its USA Trump problem. I can't tell if we're for engagement with China or if we're for isolating it. I can't tell if we're just don't have enough of a coherent approach that we're allowing them to run the table against us in all kinds of international fora, from security issues in the South China Sea to finance issues involving multilateral lending institutions. What's your hot take on the rising China and how Trump is approaching it, and are we vulnerable?
So the charitable interpretation is that we have a two-track policy toward China, where we are working towards a more competitive strategy in the military realm, for instance, but the president is working hard to maintain working relationships at the leader-to-leader level so we can address issues like North Korea. That's the charitable version. The less charitable version is that we have an incoherent China policy, because I think there is a very strong consensus at the level of sort of cabinet secretaries that the United States needs a more competitive, even in some cases confrontational approach to China, given the extent to which China has been expanding its influence in the Asia-Pacific and in other realms in recent years. But the president really doesn't seem to be buying into that. And so the president will occasionally buy into the idea that China has been exploiting the United States economically. And so he certainly thinks that there's an economic competition there. But it was just remarkable when he went to Beijing in November Xi Jinping basically had Donald Trump eating out of his hand, talking about what a great leader Xi was and how Trump didn't mind that China was running a massive trade deficit. This was America's fault, not China's. And so I think that it really just testifies to the importance of Trump's personality and the sort of leaders that Trump is attracted to. And so I worry that that aspect of the relationship is going to have the effect of undercutting the more competitive aspect of the relationship. I think that the administration initially made a very big mistake in basically saying that we were going to hold off on things like freedom of navigation operations in the South China Sea in hopes of getting Chinese cooperation in North Korea, which really gave China all of the leverage. I think, to their credit, they've backed off of that. But they're absolutely, I think the administration absolutely is still working on the theory that you can only bring North Korea to the negotiating table with Chinese cooperation. And I think that is going to make it, that's going to pose some hard choices with respect to how competitive are we actually going to be with Beijing in the coming years.
Wonderful discussion. Thank you for the question, Lester. It looks like we only have a couple minutes left in the call today. Dr. Brands and Lester, are there any comments you'd like to make before we close the call today?
No, I would just say that I've really enjoyed the conversation, and this is, you know, an important and an interesting issue, so I always welcome the chance to have a good give and take on it.
And I'll just say I think everyone should buy Professor Brand's book.
Amen.
We echo that on this end as well. Well, everyone, you can find the book on Amazon and in the description for this teleform on our website. So on behalf of the Federal Society, I'd like to thank our speakers for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome all listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. This call is now adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.